You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, and thank you for downloading The Agenda's podcast from the 3rd of February. And on the programme today, we heard from the UAE's astronauts because Zina and I met them again yesterday at Sultan Al Niyadi's last press conference before he leaves for his six-month space mission. We heard from him and also from the UAE's first Emirati astronaut, Hazza Al Mansouri. Robbie Greenfield joined us with an update on all the latest sports news, including the fact that tickets for the Abu Dhabi F1 Grand Prix have already gone on sale. Plus, we discussed the fact that universities in the UAE will be allowed to set their own entry requirements for students studying at publicly run schools. But is the whole concept of tests completely outdated? That's what we discussed with Maria Vitoritos, who's a careers educator and coach. There's only a few weeks to go until Emirati astronaut Sultan Al Niyadi leaves for his six-month mission aboard the International Space Station. And on Thursday, he faced the world's media at a press conference at the Museum of the Future. And we were there. It was very exciting. The Museum of the Future is beautiful. I actually haven't been up to the top deck, and it is completely gorgeous up there. And it was really exciting to be at the press conference for this trip. You got a real sense of the excitement. You got a real sense of the anticipation and the importance of this mission for the UAE. Now, 41-year-old Sultan revealed so many more details about the whole liftoff. That's going to take place on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida around February the 26th. And along with the rest of his crew of four, he's now going to go into 14 days of quarantine in Houston in Texas until they fly to Florida for what they call dress day rehearsal. That's when the astronauts get into their suits and practice boarding the spaceship. Then, 2 or 3 days later, it is time for liftoff. Sultan, who's a father of five, said a member of his family would be there to watch the launch. Now, speaking to me shortly after the official press conference, Sultan Al Niyadi spoke to me personally, and he said that the physical training for the mission had been the most arduous.
I think everything is vital, important for the mission, be it physically, mentally, technically. So everything is important. Everything is helping us to conduct the mission in a good shape. So I would say the physical part is something that you cannot gain immediately. You can definitely read something and overnight you'll be ready for it. But physically you need to keep up with the base of the mission. So hopefully we're ready mentally, physically and technically.
Do you have any concerns that you might be lonely up there, that you might miss your family?
Well, definitely missing the family is my biggest concern. 6 months is a long duration, but we are lucky to have the means and the facility to communicate with them through emails, direct calls and video calls. So in that regard, hopefully we'll keep that going throughout the 6 months.
How do your children feel about you going up? Because it's about as cool as it gets having a dad who's an astronaut.
They're excited, but again, 6 months is a long duration for them. Hopefully, I can communicate every single activity I do on board and make it fun for them to watch. So I want to keep that going throughout the 6 months, and hopefully it'll be manageable for them to wait for that long duration.
Of course, you'll also be communicating with school children more generally back here on Earth. Of course, one of the major aims of the mission is to encourage more children to go into science, more children to want to become astronauts. How big a deal is that for you?
Absolutely. This is one of the biggest parts of the mission, is to spread the enthusiasm and make the children seek STEM education. That is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And hopefully, in the future, they choose a career that is dedicated to these elements. And hopefully, they will seek a very productive career in the future, be it an astronaut, a researcher, or an engineer that builds rockets. So yes, that is a big part of the mission that we are conducting in the future.
I'm unduly preoccupied with the creature comforts that you're going to get up there. I worry about snacks, for example. Have you been able to choose your food?
Well, yes. Luckily, we have a very big menu. I think we spent a week trying different items, hundreds, literally hundreds of items that we can choose from. They say taste can change in space, but the variety we chose is, I think, sufficient for the 6 months.
How excited are you?
Well, it's really hard to describe. But I am excited. I am ready. I'm vigilant now. I'm just trying to anticipate that moment and be ready for it. But yeah, excitement is really high.
You must be nervous every time somebody sort of sneezes anywhere near you, because health-wise, you have to be in tip-top condition, don't you?
Now, quarantine is a thing. In the first mission, it wasn't a thing. When we say quarantine, nobody knows what a quarantine is. After COVID, yes, it is something that we take seriously. Hopefully, once we're done here, we go into the quarantine period to make sure that we are safe and sound to travel to the International Space Station.
That is Sultan Al-Niyadi. Now, during the press conference, I asked him a question. And the UAE's first astronaut, Hazza Al-Mansouri, who was also on stage, chipped in cheekily at the end. Just have a listen to this.
Are you allowed to take any personal items with you? Because I know that space is at a premium in space.
Yes, I think we're lucky enough to take some personal items. So I can't reveal everything, but I'm taking a jiu-jitsu kimono. I like to do jiu-jitsu, so probably it's going to be fun to do it in space. I'm taking family photos, my kids' photos, and I'm taking small 10-10 rockets that I'm going to probably throw it and see whether they're going to fly or not. I assume they will, because weightless. So yeah, these are some of the items I'm going to take to the International Space Station.
I even gave him some of my personal items also. Guilty by association.
You get a sense there of the close relationship between the two astronauts, who of course have been training day in, day out with each other for probably about 3 or 4 years now. Now, of course, Hazza Al-Mansouri spent 8 days aboard the International Space Station in September 2019. He was the first Emirati in space. At the event, I asked him, what advice had he been giving Sultan?
From the get-go, from the beginning, actually, we started together in training in my first mission, and I am now on backup crew for him. So my advice to him, it's been always focus on your training and enjoy every bit of it, like especially floating in space and watching Earth from there. It is a view that few people just have that privilege to see it from there. So enjoy it and make sure that you take this experience with you back home and share to their kids and to their family.
Of course, he is going to be up there for 6 months. Is there a little bit of you that feels a bit jealous?
I am happy for him. He was there for me in the first mission. Yes, it was a short mission, and he's going to do a 6-month mission. So it's a bit different. And I'm going to help him, actually, in this mission. I'm going to be in the ground doing like Capcom training for him, communicating with him while he's up there. So I'm going to be with him somehow. Yes, he's still stuck with me.
You're very much part of the same team. And that's what's so lovely about the Mohammed bin Rashid Space Centre, is you get a real sense that the astronaut program is teamwork. I'd like to ask, how has life been since you came back to Earth with a bump?
It was busy. I mean, like, just to go to space and come back, people, they want to ask you a lot of questions regarding space, experience, and that's a big thing, especially kids. You want to make sure that you transfer this experience to them in a way that they have this like excitement, and they want to just do it when they grow up. So that's really important, especially kids. I love to speak to them, talk to them about space and watching Earth from there or doing experiments up there. That is by itself, it's a big and huge thing. And I'm still training to fly in future, so I think that's going to happen. So I'm always ambitious, and hopefully maybe in future I will go to the moon. You never know.
There are always more missions, aren't there? Last question for you. When you close your eyes at night, are you able to remember that feeling of weightlessness?
I register every second of that feeling, you know. Just the first couple of seconds that when I experienced weightlessness, it was first time for me and for my colleague on that same capsule, Jessica Mir. Both of us, it was first flight for us. Just feeling weightlessness, the first time, first hand, looking at the Earth getting smaller as you go up, elevating to get closer to the space station, that was a feeling and a view that I will never forget. I always remind myself about that. Watching videos, it is really something you want to do it again in future.
That is Hazza Al-Mansouri, of course, the UAE's first astronaut to ever go to space. He spent 8 days aboard the International Space Station in September 2019, giving us there a few hints about other potential missions that the Mohammed bin Rashid Space Centre might be undertaking. If Hazza Al-Mansouri thinks that one day he might set foot on the moon, then it's fair to say that the Mohammed bin Rashid Space Centre might be planning a mission there. It was absolutely fascinating to attend that press conference in the Museum of the Future yesterday afternoon. Really exciting stuff. Now, we are discussing the UAE's latest space mission on the program this morning, as Emirati astronaut Sultan Al Niyadi has hosted his last press conference before he leaves for his six-month mission aboard the International Space Station. During a panel discussion, the 41-year-old opened up about preparing for the long-haul mission, saying he'd miss his wife and children. He's got five children, but he's hoping to keep them abreast of everything he's doing through email and phone calls from space. Now, also speaking at the press conference was Salam Al-Mahri. He's the Director General of the Mohammed bin Rashid Space Centre and head of the astronaut programme there. Now, while he was on stage, he was asked about the proudest moment of his career so far.
For me, maybe when Hazak came back. So for me, you know, it's a relaxation when the astronaut comes back, he's safe and sound. And then when we were there somewhere in the middle of Kazakhstan in the desert, and you see that capsule landing and then they come out safe, that was the proudest moment, but also the most calming moment for me. Because, you know, they're excited to go to space, but people on the ground are very nervous for them to return safely and a successful mission. So I hope that answers your question. Yes.
Now, I also caught up with Salam Al-Mahri a little bit earlier and wanted to ask exactly what Sultan Al Niyadi will be doing during his 6 months in space. This was his answer.
Well, I can tell you he's not going to be sleeping a lot. So we made sure that these 6 months he's going to be very busy. They do have a natural working day. So if we go through a process, you know, they wake up about 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning, which would be GMT time. Of course, then they have their a morning routine, which is, you know, washing up, teeth, breakfast, etc., for a set period of time. Then they have usually a debrief from mission control. So that would be from Houston. We would be participating in that, which is, you know, what they'll go through throughout the day. And then their life is pretty much that they have a laptop which has their schedule, and they've got, you know, chunks of 10, 15, 20, 30 minutes. And most of that would be science or maintenance works or outreach work. So if it's science, it's, you know, conducting the different experiments. And I said, you know, probably 60% of their work would be that. And they would go to those devices, do the experiments. They might not even be experts in those experiments. They follow the instructions and they implement it. Maintenance work might be, you know, things that need fixing in or outside of station. So if there are, you know, elements of installing new facilities, that's what astronauts would do. And then they'd go through a process like that. And then you have, of course, the final element, which is education outreach, which is quite a lot of things. So it's, you know, recording videos of this is how I brush my teeth. This is a tour of the ISS. And these things might seem simple, but it's very difficult to prepare for those and to, you know, film them. But also they're very important, you know, because that's what the majority of us on the ground would look at. We're not looking at the boring science or the maintenance issues. We're looking at, you know, how do you brush your teeth? How do you wash your hair? And how do you and, you know, can you talk live to Georgia Tully on the radio?
Yes,
those
I was going to say,
that we want to look at.
That's definitely on day 32 of the mission. I'd like to just add that in at 10 a.m. Well, actually, GMT, that would be 6 a.m. GMT, just so you know the time difference, you know, just so he's clear. I mean, one of the big things, as soon as you said sort of external repairs, everyone always gets very excited about astronauts doing space walks. Now, why is that such an iconic moment in any astronaut's life?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think one of the things is that is something that's very dangerous. So, you know, it's something that's done only when it's necessary. So something that's quite dangerous and difficult and hard to train for, I think always brings that level of excitement, and you know, that's what we would look at as, you know, that's the real job of an astronaut, you know, they, when they wear that suit and they go out. So EVAs are dangerous, they're complex, they're very hard to plan, very hard to implement, and they need a lot of training. But also it's, you become in your own space shuttle or your own spacecraft. So that is, you know, the way when astronauts come out of the spacecraft itself, and then they, you know, they float in space and they're looking at Earth. Those types of
experience,
that type of feeling,
yeah.
That type of experience is what basically makes people feel that they're close to being in space. So when astronauts go out of the hatch, look at Earth, and they're floating there, and they see nothing else, that is a feeling like no other.
Yeah, I can imagine. And is Sultan Al Niyadi trained to do that type of mission? Or as a, I mean, I don't know, do you have to be a very experienced astronaut who's done several missions to be allowed to do those?
No, he's been trained. So Sultan, Hazza, and Noura, and Muhammad are all been trained or currently training on it. So if we talk about Sultan and Hazza, they are fully trained as EVA astronauts, so they have the capability to do that. They do continuously runs in the pool in the big neutral buoyancy lab in Houston, where they don the EVA suit on, and they go on a full-size mock-up of the ISS in the pool for about 8 hours at a time. You have divers around you and the whole mission control set up, and you go through scenarios that you would go on the ISS. So are they capable and are they trained? 100% yes.
That was Sultan Al-Niyadi, who is head of the UAE's astronaut program and also director general of the Mohammed bin Rashid Space Center. That was all off the back of the two astronauts, Sultan Al-Niyadi and Hazza Al-Mansouri, hosting the very last press conference before Sultan Al-Niyadi goes up into space for his 6 month mission aboard the International Space Station. As engineer Salam Al-Mari mentioned just there, we are indeed hoping to get an interview live from space with Sultan Al-Niyadi. It's not going to necessarily be on day 32, but we certainly have marked his dance card as far as that is concerned. Hello there. Welcome back to The Agenda. And I'm going to welcome another person onto the radio with a very recognisable voice indeed, because Robbie Greenfield is joining me to keep us updated today on all the sports headlines. Robbie, how are you? Good to hear from you.
Yeah, very well. Thank you, Georgia. Yourself?
Very well indeed. Thank you for waking up early to come. And well, I'm sure you're awake, but thank you for coming on the radio early.
Well, this is early. I'm not going to get too much sympathy.
Well, no, you're not.
It's always a pleasure.
Lovely to have you on. And I know that you've got a busy day ahead of you because you're going to the races this afternoon, aren't you?
Yeah, we're part of the official Dubai World Cup Carnival, which is obviously building up to the big one at the end of March. That is the Dubai World Cup, one of the most prestigious meetings in all of racing, and looking forward to dusting out probably the slightly more smarter attire. We're wondering whether Sona Rapani is going to wear a hat. I will not be wearing a hat.
You could wear a top hat.
I might extend as far as a jacket. We'll see.
Well, it's very exciting stuff, and you'll be there every single Friday. So you get to go out and about. I'm very jealous stuck here in the studio, but at least you have joined us to keep us entertained, because I hear that the F1 tickets for Abu Dhabi were launched last night. I saw a few videos on our social. There were ladies in silver with disco balls. I'm sure that was part.
Yes.
I'm sure that was relevant.
It was a heck of a show, actually. They had the official launch evening at the Skylight Lounge, far too cool for me, Georgia, at the W Hotel. But more to the point, I think it really is indicative of how in demand F1 is at the moment, that they've actually brought this launch forward. The reason they've done that is because they didn't want the tickets to sell out before they could actually announce that they were for sale. And obviously, there's a lot of international fans that come over. I think about 70% of the spectators at the F1 do travel from overseas, and it's quite unique in that respect. There's a lot of high-profile sporting events here in the UAE, but unquestionably the most successful one at converting, you know, its sort of overall experience into a fan destination is Formula One. There's no doubt about that. We all know about the after-race concerts. We know about the kind of appeal of going and attending the race. And this year, it's the 15th edition of the Formula One, and in the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix. And they've had a bit of a rebrand. They've launched a new website, abudhabigp.com. That's where you can buy your tickets. There are a limited number available. So I guess the message to F1 fans is act quickly or you may be disappointed. And I do mean that, because with the launch of Drive to Survive on Netflix, with the growth of Formula One around the world, obviously we've seen a huge growth in the United States in popularity. It's never had it better than it has right now. And we want to see a bit more drama on the track next year, George.
We
this
do.
Coming year.
It was great.
It was too one-sided last year. Max Verstappen was too dominant, and F1 needs rivalries. We saw the previous year, Verstappen-Hamilton. You remember the drama.
Oh,
everyone
yes.
does. It came
I was
down
there.
To the last race.
I was there. Yeah, it was amazing. It was amazing.
It was. And that's the potential the sport has. But often with Formula One, you know, if teams aren't all on it right from the word go, like Mercedes dropped the ball last season, and as a result, they were playing catch-up the entire season. We've seen Red Bull, the strength they've got, and Max Verstappen in absolutely his peak, you know, driving kind of form right now, and he's absolutely dominant. We just want to see maybe a comeback from Hamilton. Maybe Hamilton's teammate, George Russell, will produce something for Mercedes this season. Maybe Charles Leclerc will get his act together for Ferrari. You'd expect Verstappen to once again be not just the man to beat, but the man most likely to win a third straight championship. But who knows? A lot can happen in the off-season, and we're all going to find out. The first race, incidentally, first weekend of March, is the first opening season race in Bahrain.
My goodness me. And it is, Abu Dhabi is still the last season of the race, isn't it? That hasn't been
it
snaffled.
Is. Okay. Yes, no, absolutely not. No, Abu Dhabi is the finale. And I just hope that this time it goes down to the wire and we get to see a title on the line like we did a couple of years ago when Abu Dhabi and Max Verstappen and Lewis Hamilton had that incredibly dramatic finish.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Okay, Six Nations starting tomorrow, so a bit of a focus on rugby over the weekend. We've got Wales versus Ireland and Scotland versus England. Is rugby popular out here in the UAE in the same way as it is in the United Kingdom?
I mean, it does very well when it comes to international rugby. There's no doubt about that. I always feel that club rugby struggles in a way to kind of, you know, transcend its popularity onto a global level. But international rugby, the Autumn Internationals, the Six Nations, obviously the World Cup takes place in France a little bit later on this year. That is, again, another sport that's really having a boon time at the moment. People are absolutely loving the rugby. And we're really excited about this Six Nations. Believe it or not, Ireland will begin as the bookmakers' favourite. France are the defending champions. They conquered all before them last season. But with the way the fixtures are, with the form that Andy Farrell's Ireland are in, they will begin this as the favourites, closely followed by France, and then a new-look England under a new coach, under Steve Borthwick. And he's actually made some selection changes. He's veered away from the tendencies of his predecessor, Eddie Jones, to kind of pick players who've traditionally done well for England. So the likes of Manu Tuilagi has lost his place to the centre, Joe Marchant. The winger, Ollie Hassel, has come in as well. So there's a few changes from England's perspective. And Gregor Townsend, incidentally, from Scotland manager, the Scotland coach, he's actually left a few high-profile players on the bench, the likes of Ali Price, Chris Harris, Xander Fagerson, Hamish Watson. They are players that have represented the Lions, which is the ultimate honour as a home nation rugby player, and yet they've been left on the bench. So a lot of competition for places in the squads of these teams, and managers maybe just mixing it up before the opener. But in terms of the fixtures, Georgia, in terms of tomorrow, we've got to look forward to the opening match is Wales against Ireland. That one kicks off at 6:15 local time. And then at 9:15 local time is the Calcutta Cup. That's England-Scotland, the old rivalry there, with Italy taking on France. That's a Sunday match, and that one gets underway at 7 p.m.
Exciting stuff. Plenty to look forward to over the weekend. How about Premier League football also returning tonight? Give us a full update, please.
Yeah, well, we've just seen the close of the January transfer window, and that's been an interesting one because never before has the Premier League been as dominant in the transfer window or indeed in the transfer market as it has been over the last month or so. I'll give you a couple of stats. The Premier League spent a totally mind-boggling £815 million on players during the January transfer window. By the way, Georgia, most of these players were just like, they were just like squad boosters.
Whoa.
Most of the big, big transfers we see in the summer when there's a genuine off-season, January tends to be, think of bargain basement, think of last-minute panic buys, think of January sales on the high street. That's kind of where the Premier League was at over these last couple of weeks. And they've absolutely splurged, as one commentator said, like a drunken sailor, which I thought was a lovely turn of phrase. Yes, indeed. Yeah. So the money that has been spent just by Chelsea alone, Chelsea, the biggest spenders of the Premier League transfer window, they spent more than the combined totals of Spain, Italy, Germany and France in all of their top divisions. So it just gives you a kind of indication as to,
it's bonkers.
I mean, I'm not saying the Premier League is dominant on the pitch, but it's certainly dominant when it comes to buying players and the sort of sheer power of the transfer window. And Chelsea, who have bought Enzo Fernandez for a Premier League record £107 million, I believe he may make his debut, actually, tonight, in fact, when they host Fulham. I think we can actually hear from the manager, Graham Potter.
Yeah, we can.
These stories, it won't be the first, it won't be the last. He's a professional player. He understands the situation. He's committed to us. He's available for the squad.
Yeah, so there we go. That was Graham Potter there talking about Chaim Ziyech. He missed out on a move to Paris Saint-Germain due to paperwork issues. But Graham Potter says the forward still has an important part to play. It's really interesting how these managers have to piece their team together. Do the managers get a say in who gets bored? You'd presume they would, but they keep on. I've heard many a manager saying it's nothing to do with me. It's, you know, it's the chairman.
Yeah, a lot of it is the chairman. You know, it's the kind of like, what's the bright new toy in the toy shop that I can go out and buy? There's some of that. A lot of clubs have directors of football. They have heads of recruitment, obviously. The teams are bigger. I mean, football doesn't operate in the same way that it did, you know, a few decades ago, where the manager would essentially do most of the recruitment, or at least he would rely on a few trusted scouts to go out and actually procure these players and get them signed. But now I think the manager is consulted. Some clubs lean on the manager more heavily than others. I mean, I think if you are building a team, it stands to reason that the manager should be the most important person to make a decision on,
yeah,
on the player that they want to buy. But you've just got more. Too many cooks are perhaps spoiling the broth, Georgia, when it comes to signing players. And that's why we've seen some of these signings, a lot of these signings, for big, big money, not work out. I mean, Chelsea are a case in point. They've spent so big, and yet there's a question mark hanging over all of these signings. So we wait to see whether they can actually stitch a really good team together. Graham Potter has bought young. He's bought for the future. He's kind of invested in a team that he thinks is going to peak in maybe 2, 3, 4 years' time. And Enzo Fernandez, a case in point, the Argentinian, is in his early 20s. And most of the players that Potter has signed have been youngsters. But at the same time, they're not finished products. They're not the finished article. So, you know, Chelsea are struggling at the moment in the Premier League. There's no doubt about that. It's definitely a transitional season for them, and it's almost a write-off for them. I think Graham will get a chance in the summer to maybe make one or two more recruitments, maybe get rid of a few players, and then he's got a team that he needs to build and actually needs to get results from. But it's going to be interesting to see how he manages to kind of deal with that level of incoming players. I mean, huge amount of new players have joined, and we wait to see on Chelsea's fortunes. But just quickly looking ahead to the weekend, we're going to be, of course, on air 4 until 7 on Extra Time on the weekend tomorrow, Georgia. And the big one, I guess, tomorrow in terms of the fixtures would have to be, well, Manchester United are flying high. They're playing Crystal Palace. That's a 10 p.m. kickoff. The early one, 7:30, Everton versus Arsenal. And that's going to be interesting as well. Arsenal, of course, Premier League leaders, going away to Everton, who have a new manager in Sean Dyche. We'll expect an improvement from them. That's going to be an intriguing one.
Absolutely fantastic. Plenty for people to look forward to over the weekend. Obviously, they need to keep it locked on Dubai 103.8, not just tonight for Offscript from the races, but also over the weekend for Extra Time. Is it Tom presenting this weekend, or are you keeping him company?
Actually, I am going to be taking over from Mr. Urquhart for just one weekend only. I just can't get enough of it at the moment, Georgia.
Goodness me.
I haven't had a day off in about 20 days. But,
let's keep it rolling.
Bring it on.
Let's keep you rolling. if you stop, you'll get ill. So let's just keep you going. Let's literally keep, yeah. I was going to say something there, which wouldn't work on the radio. There is too much going on. Fantastic. Thank you so much, as ever, Robbie Greenfield. A delight to have on the radio. And of course, you'll get much more from him a little bit later on today from 5 o'clock. We've got a breaking story today, and it's all regarding universities in the UAE, because they're now going to be allowed to set their own entry requirements for students who are studying at publicly run schools. It's a major change. It was announced by the Ministry of Education. Basically, it all surrounds the Emirates Standardised Test, which is known as MSAT. That is no longer going to be mandatory for admission to college or university. And that is going to take effect in September when the new academic year starts. So universities can now choose either MSAT, and they can set minimum scores needed by students, or, and this is the big one, they can rely on final exams approved by the ministry. And they can also, you know, request other approved assessments such as A-levels or the International Baccalaureate instead. Now, the gist behind this is all about raising the standards of higher education and modernising the system here. And it's part of a bigger picture. Basically, the UAE is working on its educational system at the moment, and we are expecting further announcements about the changes that they're making. But there are pupils who may be really good in sort of tests that exams don't cover, and there is a sense that maybe they might be left behind if they can't pass the test. OK, so let's talk about college admission tests. And, you know, do you you know, could we see a change? Could we see a moment when a test isn't required? It all comes down to an interview, maybe. We're joined live now by Maria Vitoritos, who is a careers educator and coach, joining me on Teams. Maria, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. Really interesting to talk to you about this, because there's lots of talk about exams in every single sort of stage of the educational system. Do you think that higher education and entry to higher education needs to be changed, needs to be modernized?
I think it's really important to remember that this conversation is very subjective and it depends on the intention and the agenda behind the assessment. If that makes any sense.
Well, I'd like you to expand on it, certainly.
Yeah, definitely. So without boring everyone, it's really important to remember why these assessments exist. So if we look at the US, for example, where you have schools that don't follow a national curriculum like the United Kingdom would, that means that in different states, you would have students going and doing different assessments, different tests, different measures of success in academics. If you look at the international schools across the globe, you'll have the same dilemma. So the intention behind the assessments, I believe, was an intention, if we are going to be really kind and considerate, to kind of make it a safe playing field where everyone could be judged fairly. However, with what you already explained, not all students perform equally in an exam situation. And also, if we're looking at what are we actually measuring when we're doing this type of testing, it's questionable. And this is the great debate amongst educators across the globe. But it's not just about entrance assessments to higher education. Assessments across the board are being heavily criticized by educators. And there's a great debate in the purpose. And I think in the pandemic, when we saw students unable to sit these formal assessments for higher education, as an example, there were ways around it. There were ways to measure success. So it's not impossible. The question is, what's the intention and whose agenda is on the table when we are testing students?
The problem that universities and colleges face, though, is if they're getting thousands of applications, they need something to, you know, they need some way to filter out the people who just aren't bright enough to go to uni, frankly.
And that's great. And you're right. There has to be some type of measure of making sure that the right candidates or the candidates that seem right at the time will get in. But remember, universities are always promoting students to look outside of assessment in terms of choosing a university for the cultural fit, choosing a university for the broader perspective of that university expectations. So why then are we then saying you have to do this assessment? It's really about understanding the purpose. So I think there are different ways to do it. Will we get it right immediately? Probably not. But do we keep doing what we're doing just because we don't know how to do it different? I think not. And I think that it will start taking universities to say, okay, we are going to do things different. In fact, if we're looking at the UCAS, for example, they've been promoting that it's all going to be different in terms of personal statements and referencing. So we know that there can be different ways to do things, but we have to try and figure out what those are. And I think we need to really, we need to look more finely at the purpose of these assessments.
Food for thought, indeed. Maria Vitoritos, thank you so much for your time. Really lovely to speak to you. Careers coach there and educator, also a great advisor on what you should do for your tertiary education. The Agenda is live Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. till 1 p.m.